Well, good evening. We've moved beyond the eating part of our evening, and now Dr. Watson's going to give us a brief and stirring lecture, I'm sure. Professor Francis Watson is a biblical scholar of global reputation who is recognized for his creative and original scholarship, especially in the area of biblical hermeneutics and the relationship between scripture and theology. After earning the Doctor of Philosophy degree from Oxford University in 1984, he served on the faculties of King's College London and the University of Aberdeen. Since 2007, he is research chair in biblical interpretation at Durham University. Professor Watson has authored or edited 7 books and has written numerous articles which have appeared in books and leading academic journals. He served as the editor of the Journal for the Study of the New Testament and has lectured broadly in Europe and North America. And without further ado, I introduce Dr. Watson. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me know if you can't hear me at the back. I should be able to hear myself in this intimate space. That's page 1 of my lecture. Well, there it is. Yes, it's not actually a lecture. Well, it's an honour and a pleasure to have given the Theta Phi lectures and also to address you now at the Theta Phi banquet, which we've been enjoying together. But why Theta Phi? What's the significance of those 2 Greek letters? Don't tell me anyone, because the whole thing is based on the fact. I don't know. It's a question that's been worrying me for some time, but I haven't yet succeeded in tracking down the answer, what the significance of these letters is. I looked on the web, which usually has the answer to every possible question, no matter how specialised or esoteric. But all the web told me was that the Theta Phi Society is an international honour society in the field of religion. Well, fine, but that didn't help me with those Greek letters. And even the web couldn't help me break the code. Well, lecture series are often named after the benefactors who endowed them. So in Scotland, for example, there were the Gifford Lectures, named after Lord Gifford, an immensely wealthy 19th century aristocrat who made provision for a lecture series on natural rather than revealed religion to be held at each of the 4 ancient Scottish universities of Edinburgh, Glasgow, St Andrews and Aberdeen. So that suggested a possible solution to the puzzle of the Theta Phi lectures. Perhaps Theta and Phi were the initial letters of some long-deceased Greek benefactor of the seminary who endowed the Theta Phi lectures and founded the Theta Phi Society. But why then the initials rather than the full name? Well, perhaps his full name contained too many syllables for English speakers to feel comfortable with. That's sometimes the way I find with Greek names. His name might have been something like Theophilos Philippopoulos. See why people might have wanted to abbreviate that to just Theta Phi. So this seemed like a pretty good solution to me, but after a while doubts began to creep in. As far as I could tell from the other side of the Atlantic, Asma doesn't really have any very obvious Greek connections. Apologies if I'm quite wrong about that. Well, I thought I was probably wrong, but as far as I could tell. So that endowment from Mr. Philippopoulos, a successful Athens businessman with connections both to the Methodist Church and to the United States of America, was probably just a figment of my imagination. So in the end, I gave up my struggle with those 2 Greek letters. There must be a meaning somewhere around the back of them, but I couldn't find a way to extract it. So in the absence of the real meaning, I decided to invent a meaning of my own. Theta. What does that suggest? Theta stands for theologia, theology. What about phi? Phi, I decided, stands for philia, friendship. An unexpected combination, perhaps. All the same, I wanted to talk to you briefly about theology and friendship. I want to suggest that as we study theology, we make a whole lot of new acquaintances, some of whom may become lifelong friends and permanently affect the way we think, speak, and act. This theological friendship circle includes the biblical writers, but it also includes Christian theologians from the early centuries down to the present. At first, these people are hardly even names for us when we begin the study of theology. Then we begin to learn a bit about their ideas and why they're regarded as important. And at that point, perhaps we even begin to read their writings, and it gradually becomes clear to us why their ideas matter to them, and sometimes how their ideas are still of great significance to us. In this way, a stranger becomes an acquaintance, and an acquaintance becomes a friend. It might be a biblical writer, it might be the prophet Jeremiah or the apostle Paul, or it might be St. Augustine or Julian of Norwich or John Wesley or Karl Barth, or a host of others, of course. Studying theology can, I think, make these people, people like this, our friends. Even if they're deceased, they live on in their writings. Though dead, they still speak. Unfortunately, some people have a quite different attitude to the study of theology. They're suspicious of it, and they don't see the point of it. They think it's enough just to have the Bible. If God speaks to us through the Bible day by day, why should we need to study academic theology? Head knowledge is all very well, they say, but God is truly known in and through the heart. What we know in our hearts is far more important than what we know in our heads. A common view, and I personally think it's all wrong. I used to attend a church where the minister was particularly fond of this head knowledge, heart knowledge contrast. And I always wanted to say to him that, so far as I understood human anatomy, the head and the heart are actually really rather closely connected. You can't actually have a functioning head without a heart, and you can't have a functioning heart without a head. I'm not a doctor or anything, but I'm married to a doctor, and I check this with her. She tells me this is dead right. You see, you can't do it. They are actually connected. So this head knowledge, heart knowledge, just don't go there. It's bad. Don't disparage the head. It's a noble organ given to us by God, and you shouldn't disparage it. So we'll abandon that negative view of theological study, and let's return to our friendship model. Some people become our friends and others do not, and our friends are those with whom we share a common concern. It seems to be a minimal qualification for friendship that two people should have something in common, some kind of shared interest that each party recognises in the other. Most of those whose writings we study as theologians are our fellow Christians, so there's at least the potential for the shared interest or concern that makes for friendship. So friendship, I'm suggesting, can happen as we read. When you're reading a book, you are not alone, you're with someone else. You may decide in the end you don't like them at all. They're very, very boring. One of those awful occasions where you get sort of stuck in the corner with someone and they go on and on and on. You think, how can I get away? So friendship doesn't always happen as we read, but it can. I remember an experience of this in my second year of theological study at Oxford in the mid-1970s. I was taking a course in modern theology and I'd been given some sections to read from Karl Barth's Monumental Church Dogmatics. At first I struggled with this. I tried to get my mind round Barth's doctrine of the Trinity, but got lost in his talk of revealer, revelation, and revealedness, and of the three divine modes of being, Seinsweise. What was revealedness supposed to be? Met it before. You know, the word existed, and I couldn't see why it should exist. What on earth was a mode of being? I mean, how would you recognise a mode of being if you passed it in the street? I mean, absolutely no idea. Why was Karl Barth forcing his readers through these conceptual hoops? So So it wasn't a good start to my relationship with the great Swiss theologian, who'd been dead at that time for less than a decade. Then I read a quite different section from the Church Dogmatics, entitled The Way of the Son of God into the Far Country. The title obviously refers to the parable of the prodigal son, but Barth is actually writing about the incarnation, the event in which the Son of God took human form in solidarity with us and for the sake of our salvation. Arrogantly and stupidly, we've left the home in which we truly belong, and we've taken up residence in the far country where we fritter away our God-given inheritance. Precisely in this sad and disreputable place, God comes to us and meets us in Jesus Christ. Reading this section of Barth, what struck me so forcibly was that the classical Christian doctrine of incarnation is not only true, but also awe-inspiringly beautiful. I think Barth, too, had experienced this and was trying to communicate it to his readers. And when that attempt at communication was successful, when author and reader recognised a shared concern, then there was the basis for lasting friendship. Friends aren't just people whose company we enjoy, they're people who profoundly influence the way we think and act. My suggestion is that theology can initiate us into a friendship-like relationship to the figures whose texts we study, whether these are biblical writers or ancient or modern theologians. Friendships change us. Once they spring up, we won't remain the same. So that's my take on those mysterious Greek letters, theta and phi. Theta stands for theologia, theology, and phi for philia, friendship. Theta, phi, theology and friendship. Theology as friendship, or more precisely, theology as initiating us into life-transforming, friendship-like relationships with some of our great predecessors. Now someone can tell me what theta, phi really means. Thank you very much. Thank you.